All of us know that place in our community where marginalized people come together to affirm our humanity, our culture, and our community. In this place, we learn how to navigate our complicated experiences in the wider community. We discuss the issues of the day, and we build our social networks.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
In Los Angeles, the Nayarit was one of those esteemed places and spaces. In my conversation today, Professor Natalia Molina and I talk about her most recent book, A Place at the Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community. Dr. Molina shares the life of her grandmother, Doña Natalia, and how her restaurant operated as an urban anchor, an important site for community building. Dr. Natalia Molina is a distinguished professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. She is also a 2020 MacArthur Fellow. Enjoy our conversation and see the show notes for more information about Dr. Molina. As always, make sure you subscribe to the Empowerment Zone podcast and give us a rating on Apple Podcast. Your support will make sure that we continue our journey in empowerment and impact. Hi, Dr. Natalia Molina. Welcome to the Empowerment Zone. It is such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the work you're doing here, and I'm happy to be in conversation with you.
Yes, so I have been reading your book, A Place at the Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community, and I'm really loving this book, and I just want to know a little bit, how did you begin writing this book? What was your interest in exploring this restaurant and this story?
The book is based on my grandmother's restaurant called the Nayarit, which is named after her home state of Mexico. And so I've known this story my entire life, but I didn't really think about writing about it for a long time. It wasn't until after I finished my second monograph called How Race is Made in America that I was asked to give a keynote at a conference, and it needed to be on some aspect of California history. And having just finished a book that in part was on California history, I didn't really have new material. And then I thought about the Nayarit. And I thought about it for two reasons. One, I had grown up with this story. I'd grown up in the same neighborhood where the restaurant was established, in the same home that my grandmother purchased. And that neighborhood is called Echo Park. Echo Park is a unique neighborhood because it's a geographic crossroads. It's between all these different freeways. It's just, you know, northwest of downtown LA and just east of Hollywood. And so it's also this cultural crossroads in terms of ethnic groups, racial groups, classes, people coming from all different walks of life. And so I knew that from my experience growing up as a Latina in this cultural crossroads, it was very different than friends that I had that had grown up in predominantly Latino neighborhoods like East Los Angeles. And so I always wanted to write about that experience. And now 15 years into being a professor of teaching urban studies and race, and seeing that most histories of urban studies and race are around Latinos in East LA, African-Americans in Houston, African-Americans in Oakland. And I wanted to get at that kind of cross-cultural, cross-racial connection. On top of that, it was a time period in which Echo Park was changing. There's been a lot of gentrification. And I was teaching at UC San Diego at the time. And when I would come visit my family in Los Angeles, I would go out, you know, to a party or something, and I would meet people and they'd say, "Oh, where are you staying while you're in LA? Echo Park. Oh, are you at an Airbnb?" "No, I'm with my family. People live there. People live there for a long time." from their community. And I really wanted that community story, the story of the urban anchors, like my grandmother's restaurant, to be historicized and for people to understand that these are areas that have a rich culture, even if they become gentrified and the income level and wealthification changes the area, it's not always seen as quote unquote better for those who have lived there for decades or even generations.
So let's look at that. You talked about this change might not be better for the community. And you also talked about urban anchor. Can you define what you mean by urban anchor?
I think when we look at a community, and I've taught urban studies for many years, we're used to looking at cities from the top down. So it might be official urban anchors like city government. It might be libraries. It might even be nonprofits. All of these are important institutions. You know, you might include libraries, I said, and I don't know what I would have done as a kid without my local library. I was there every 2 weeks. Free books, sign me up. That being said, our restaurants, our cafes, our barbershops, our nail salons, these are places where people get together, where people are used to going, hanging out with people they know, seeing regulars. Some people might go get their coffee at the same donut shop every morning. Sure, they want the donut, but they want the conversation even more. I know from also doing public health that one of the ways that people have outreach to African-American women around breast cancer, for example, is to train beauty technicians because they know these are their trusted representatives in the community. So we need a much wider way of understanding what we mean by urban anchors, not just from the top down formed by government or nonprofits, but by the people themselves. And so that's what I'm trying to get at with urban anchors, and that the people who establish these things are placemakers.
Yes, I really like how in the book you distinguish between urban institutions and urban anchors. Institutions are more, like you said, that top-down view, where urban anchors are those places and spaces that are formed by the community for the community. And so when you talk about an urban anchor and its influence on the community and Nayarit, can you talk about its impact in the community and what Nayarit meant?
Sure. So the Nayarit was a restaurant that my grandmother formed in 1951 on Sunset Boulevard and Echo Park. And, you know, this was a restaurant that quickly became a local landmark. It was popular with both Hollywood stores and restaurant workers and working class ethnic Mexicans from across the city. And it became a restaurant that was beloved for its fresh, traditionally prepared Mexican food. And so this is what made it an urban anchor. It was a gathering space where ethnic Mexican workers and customers were able to connect with what people call Patria Chica, like their small country. So not necessarily Mexico as a whole nation, but the state of Nayarit, that regional understanding of Mexico, that very specific understanding of Mexico. My grandmother, who I refer to as Doña Natalia, I'm named after her, helped nurture this community. And so after immigrating alone from Mexico to LA in 1921, she adopted two children, my mom and my uncle, and she, you know, ran the successful business, and then she went on to sponsor dozens of other immigrants. And, you know, she had a couple rules. You had to work at a restaurant. You had to live in her home because she had this sense of decorum. She wanted to make sure people were chaperoned and, you know, weren't just moving from Mexico. A lot of them were younger, young women especially. But she also wanted them to have a sense of belonging in LA. And so she also encouraged them to speak English, to learn English if they could, and to also go out in the city. So this was especially significant because LA is a city that has long been a segregated city. We only need to look at the government's redlining maps from the 1930s to see how segregated it was. And these restaurant workers went on to move their ways up the ranks from busboy to waiter to to cook. Some of them went on to open their own restaurants. And so it's really a story of this immigrant experience of network, family, community, and how people face the pressures of racism and segregation, how they experience pleasure, daily life, right? That the immigrant experience isn't just about toiling away, that people do have these moments of pleasure. And so in the end, the Nayarit is an urban anchor because it created a sense of belonging. And it was a place where people could feel like insiders, especially when other parts of the city, they felt like outsiders.
So it was a place for community, but it was also a place where you could probably debate politics, right? Deal with social issues, deal with how to address racism and segregation and all those factors of life of being a member of a group that is marginalized by the wider society. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think we could think about politics at different levels at this way, right? There are ways in which people just literally did exactly what you said, debated politics, met before and after organizing meetings, where organizations met, political organizations met, such as the Mexican American Bar Association. They had a restaurant in East Los Angeles that was kind of their official meeting spot, but the Nayarit was one of the places that they would meet. A representative, a city council member, Edward Roybal, would also sometimes have meetings and banquets there. He's the first Mexican American elected to city council. Let me just repeat that. The first Mexican American elected to city council during, you know, since the American period after 1848, when Mexico cedes a third of its land to the US. You know, so 100 years after that, even in a city that we think about as so Latino, so diverse, and the West is so progressive, it takes 100 years for him just to become a city councilman. I'm not talking mayor or anything. So there was those kind of politics. On top of that, there are also the ways in which the wait staff would connect with those people. If they had a legal question, if they wanted some advice, they knew people from outside of their community that they could ask. My grandmother also uniquely, for whatever reason, I never met her, so I couldn't ask her this question. She hired an attorney, which was interesting. She always had an attorney. And so what she used the attorney for was to write letters of employment for Mexican relatives and friends in Mexico, so that when they were applying for their visa, they could show that they were already going to have a job in the US when they showed up, which enabled them to get a visa. So not only was she able to immigrate people, she was able to immigrate them legally. And that is not that, she did not understand that not everybody could do that and some people were going to be undocumented. It was that she knew that by immigrating legally, not only would that one entry across the border be easier, but it meant that they could work at the front of the house without fear. It meant that they could get their green card if they wanted. Very few people at this time became citizens, so I don't think she was thinking of that. But they could get Social Security. You know, they could work legally, and it meant that they just didn't have to hide in the shadows in the same way. So there were politics at that level. I would also argue her food was a political act. At this point, you're seeing a lot of the restaurants, Mexican restaurants, and you could say this for Chinese restaurants as well. The ones that have success are the ones that have kind of homogenized their foods. You know, this like kind of chop suey for Chinese restaurants, for Mexican restaurants, like a taco enchilada combo with, yellow cheese and all these things that you do to Americanize and standardize that food. And she certainly had some of that. You know, she definitely was catering to white collar workers coming from downtown LA. But she also had parts of her menu that were place-based from the state of Nayarit. You know, she had shrimp dishes. And I always think of like the Mexican Forrest Gump when I go back to Mexico, because I'm like, we have shrimp tacos, we have shrimp meatballs, we have shrimp soup, we have shrimp empanadas, we have shrimp tamales, we have shrimp everything. She would make these whole fishes that were seasoned in herbs. And it's exactly the kind of thing that when you go to Nayarit's beaches that you have under one of those open air huts. So she would do those kinds of things. Those things also were more expensive and those ingredients were harder to procure. So she did little things like the gorditas in Nayarit, these corn filled, the kind of little pockets of masa that you stuff with like meat and lettuce and cotija, fresh cheese, not that yellow cheese. Mm-hmm. Those are ubiquitous there. And since those are kind of harder to make to order, she would make tacos, but she would still bathe it with this tomato bath that we use for the gorditas. So it's like a tomato with chicken broth and little cloves of garlic that you then blend up and put that sauce on. To this day, when I go to a place, and I write this in the epilogue of the restaurant, when I go to a place and I taste something with that sauce, it's like my little pick up and I say, where are you from in Nayarit? And they're like, how do you know? I'm like, the tomato bath. You just know.
Man, you just explored so much in just that few minutes. When you look at the fact that this was a place that the leaders of the time met, organizations within the community met. You talk about Edward Robal, who was the first city council, Mexican-American city councilman in Los Angeles, who became congressman and whose daughter is now Congressman Lucille, I believe, Robal, and how that was a place and space for him. And then the organizations you talked about, how they meet before and after the meeting or whatever issue they're addressing, and just the different level of politics, whether it had to do with, like you stated, getting visas for immigrants and getting them to be able to work and live with dignity and not have to live in the shadows, and also the fact that your grandmother used food as a political statement as well. Like, we will still have our authentic food here at the restaurant. There's so much that is wrapped up in the, when you talk about the different levels of politics and the use of the cotija cheese versus this yellow cheese, just all of that. It just so much reminds me of living in Atlanta after I finished college. Well, excuse me, while I was in college, I attended Clark Atlanta University, which is a historically Black institution in the center of Atlanta. And it was close to one of our urban anchors, Pascal's Restaurant, which is the place where Martin Luther King Jr., Andrew Young, all of those civil rights leaders, Reverend James Orange, all of those individuals of the civil rights movement used to meet there, have meetings, as well as community organizations. And I remember, while attending college, going to Pascal's for meetings, community meetings, such as the CBC, the Concerned Black Clergy, and hearing the politics of the day, and being a part of the strategy meetings as a student, but more so observing, even though they would ask me my opinion, more so listening and observing, and what Pascal's meant to the community, that Pascal's meant to the community. And even after finishing graduate school and coming back to Atlanta, being able to eat breakfast, which was across the street from my apartment complex, and listening to the elders talk about the politics of the day and what the issues were and how they felt one issue should go one way or the other, and influencing people who were actually the mayors and the elected officials who would come in and say, tell us, what do you think? You know, that they were listening to the elders as well. So just listening to you talk about how Doña Natalia and Nayarit influenced the community and what it meant as an urban anchor is so similar to what goes on in the African-American community, you know, and how we use places to reaffirm who we are, right? and how we address how to be an African-American in society. So I really appreciated learning how your grandmother influenced this one little story, influenced so much, and just to be able to compare it to some of the things that I've witnessed as a citizen of Atlanta.
Thank you for bringing up Pascal's. That is a beautiful story. And I think that, you know, as many images as we have of MLK, I think if you close your eyes and you ask people to close their eyes and say, imagine Martin Luther King Jr., you'll picture him at the, you know, at the Washington, you know, preaching on the Washington Monument, preaching, leading an important civil rights march. The man had to eat. Mm-hmm. He went to Pascal's, and that's where people debated ideas, and that's where ideas grew, and that's where other people came, politicians, as you said, and they tested out their ideas with their with the community. Is this idea going to float? Is it going to hold water? I need to test it out in the community. And that is a huge reason why I wrote this book, because, you know, I think as much as we all have a place that we go to and we feel seen and we feel comfortable, and to some extent it does the kind of work that you're saying Pascal's did, we don't think of it as necessarily having historical significance, or that somebody would allow us to write that story. Not that we don't necessarily know it's important, but would anyone allow us to write that story? And, you know, even me with a PhD, as a professor, with a job, all that, it took me a long time to say, I don't know if anyone's allowing me to write this story, but I'm going to write this story. And I know it's going to resonate with people, because I gave one talk on it and people came from all over the city to hear it, because they said, I had a place like that and I have a neighborhood like that that's changing, and I want it documented and I want people to know the importance of it. So I wrote this book because I wanted to tell this story, but because more importantly, I want everybody to tell their story of their Pascal's, of their barbershop, of their cafe, of that place that is meaningful to them. And that when they think, what does Atlanta mean to me? It means Pascal's. What does Echo Park mean to me? It means the Nayarit. And for us all be able to tell the story of our city, of our place, through the places that are meaningful to us, not that have been handed down to us and told were meaningful, such as a monument.
And that is so centered to this story, is the community's defining for ourselves what is significant to us. You know, what are the stories that are significant to our lives versus, like you said, this top-down history and having to look at history from a certain perspective and not realizing, hey, these lives matter too. These institutions, these places and spaces matter too, and shape lives even more so, because it's shaping lives on a daily basis, you know? And that's why when you look at gentrification and you look at changes of communities, how there is something lost by the communities who are considered insignificant, right? They're not important, but all of a sudden, when other places, people and places start establishing, then that all of a sudden is more important than what was there. And that's why it's so important for us to tell our own stories and decide what is significant to us. Now, Pascal's, there is a new Pascal's that has been established, but that old Pascal's is what I was talking about. It closed in the early 2000s, and just like Nayarit, when that place closed, all of a sudden there was a loss in the community, right? But more importantly, is that we understand as historians, as scholars, as people in various fields, that we decide we need to redefine what is significant and how we tell our stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell me, how did you, what is your field specifically? And how did you get into, I know you teach in American studies. I don't know if your background is American studies, but how did you get into your particular field and decide that you wanted to study culture and race?
I'm a first gen student. And so I kind of stumbled into some of this. I went to UCLA as an undergraduate and I took classes that were interesting to me. And I took a lot of history class, basically classes in humanities and social sciences. History in Latin American studies, Chicano studies, literature, also Chicano studies, and gender studies. Was an anthropologist named Sandra Hale, who studied Eritrea. And then I did a program through the Ford Foundation and the Mellon Foundation. And I think you'll see a lot of first-gen professors have been helped by some kind of program that gives them some advice of how to apply to graduate school. And that was a program that gave you all the kind of the tips on how to apply to graduate school. And so I decided, you know, I think if I'm going to go on to that, which I hadn't thought about to that point, at the most I thought about was a master's in urban studies, which is also probably why I'm all still so drawn to cities. I decided to get a PhD in history. And so I went to the University of Michigan that had a great history program, as well as a great advisor, George Sanchez, who now I'm lucky to have as my colleague at USC. And though I came out as a historian, you know, I have a PhD in history, that person who's used to looking at things through literature, anthropology, sociology, culture is still, you know, very much alive in me. So I first taught in ethnic studies, then went to history. And now I am in an American studies department, which is basically like a default ethnic studies department. So I'm in a department with anthropologists, sociologists, cultural studies folks, people from religious studies, people from all over. And so we're interested in just how we tell the story of race and ethnicity from all these different perspectives and methodologies.
So in telling stories, when you look at a place at the Nayarit, what is the impact that you want to make as a scholar?
It's funny. I was just out to dinner with my nephew last night, and you know, I've been giving different book talks, and he knows I've been doing, you know, I've been fortunate to be on podcasts like yours. And he said, "Do you ever get tired of telling your story?" I'm just so proud of it. And I'm like, well, one, I am so proud of it. You know, I'm happy to tell this story, but I'm happy to tell it also because, as I mentioned before, I know that my experience of being Latina is different from other people's, but I have the vantage point of understanding why that is as a historian. I know that it had to do with the place that I grew up with. I know that it had to do with the ways in which being Latina in Los Angeles is different than it is than what it means to be in Texas or Miami or New York. And so I want people to be able to understand that and also understand the ways that racial and ethnic communities can come together. And that book tells this story. And as I said before, I also want people to tell the story of their own urban anchor. So in addition to the book, I've been developing curriculum for K-12. In the last few weeks, I've done walking tours in San Francisco and in Scotland, and I'm looking at virtual ones right now that people have for Boyle Heights. There's a Boyle Heights Museum. And so I think there's a newsletter called Making a Neighborhood for a neighborhood in Los Angeles, the East Villa or the East Virgil area. I think this is this moment where that coupling of digital humanities and people seeing how places are changing, people are hungry to tell the story of their local community, but they don't necessarily know how. They don't want to get a PhD in history. They don't want to write a book, but maybe they want to do a great Instagram story. Maybe they want to do a great post on their blog. Maybe they want to tell their story through a short story or artwork. However that is. And so I hope that this book is inspiration and perhaps even a model of how to do that.
So Dr. Molina, I am a big advocate for higher education, and I'm sure as a professor you are too. What strategy would you give students to be successful in college? And before you give us your strategy, can you tell us what school or schools did you attend? What was your major or majors, and what degree or degrees did you earn? And then what strategy would you share with students to make sure that they're successful in college?
Well, I will answer this question not so much as a professor, but as a first-gen student. Great. So as a first-gen student, I went to UCLA. I was a gender studies major and history major. I double majored. I then, through the help of a Ford Mellon program, went on to graduate school at the University of Michigan. Thanks to a fellowship by the Rackham Division Graduate School at Michigan, it made that choice a lot easier for me, because when you're first gen and you look at all that debt, you think, how's that going to happen? Mm-hmm. And I think my advice would be, and you know, I'll just tell you the advice I gave yesterday. So I'm working with an undergraduate student. She's very smart. She wants to be an attorney. She will be an attorney, I have no doubt. My point to her was, as good as you are, ask for help. Because while you will be an attorney, you can do an LSAT prep course. She said, they're expensive. Ask for help. Say, do you know of any LSAT prep course aid that I can get? So that's her task for this week, is to research it, get back to me. And I'm going to reach out to the people that I do all my committee work with and that I do a lot of favors for. And I'm sure somebody will know something. I also just had another student reach out to me just yesterday. These are two of my best students that I've just recently had. He went through like a 4-paragraph explanation of why he's going to need a letter of recommendation for graduate school and would I even consider it. I could tell the pain he has in asking. I know he's first gen also. Again, ask for help. We're happy to help. We're happy to write those letters, especially if it's a professor of color, first gen, often women. We've had that same experience. Not that you should only ask us, because we get asked for a lot of stuff. Ask all your professors. But ask for help. Maybe some people won't give it to you, but that the worst you're going to get is no. Ask for help. Even if you know you can do it, you could probably do it better, cheaper, easier if you ask for help.
Thank you so much for that advice. I mean, especially all students, but especially first-gen students, because first-gen students don't come in with the knowledge and understanding and the support systems that most people who are children of college graduates come in. So they don't know they can ask for help. They don't know that professors, administrators, staff members are there to support them and want to see them succeed. You know, and I remember when I was in graduate school, there was support, there were things that could provide you with support that I've never heard of, like a speed reading class. One of my professors told me about that, because we were required to read 3 books a week, one for each class. You know, how are you getting through these? They're not reading every single thing on the page, they're speed reading. And so you have to learn how to ask for help, because it will help you so much in making sure you don't have the anguish such as the four paragraphs for asking for a letter. You know that people are there to support you. So thank you so much, Dr. Molino, for that advice. I'm sure it's going to be helpful to a lot of people.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.